You are listening to the Plan B podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the Plan B podcast. I know, we've uploaded, we've really had a lack of uploads in the last couple of months, and we apologize for it. But this episode, I think, definitely makes up for it. My guest today is Rob Price. Rob is an economist. He was head of asset allocation at a top South African pension fund. He's now in the US managing a Bitcoin-only fund. He's also the writer of the prolific blog, Sound Money Macro. I reached out to Rob on Twitter to see if he would be available for a virtual interview and found out that he was actually in South Africa at the time. When we did the interview, it was around June, July, just after the El Salvador Bitcoin announcement, as you can gather from the podcast. So yeah, we focus a lot on that, even though it might seem like old news at the moment, obviously being in December. But at the time, it was just after the announcement had happened. So we go into the Bitcoin El Salvador announcement. We go into Bitcoin as a inflation hedge. We go into the crazy modern monetary theory that central banks have been applying in the last couple of months. It really is an exceptional chat. I've learned so much from Rob. He's a great thinker, a brilliant economic, political mind, and just an all-around nice guy. I really appreciate having him on and him making the time for us. And I hope you guys enjoy the chat. Welcome to the Plan B podcast. Today I have with me Rob Price. Rob, thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you, Esfia.
There's a lot that I want to get into, but maybe just to start off, do you mind explaining who is Rob Price and, you know, what's his background?
Yeah, sure. So I characterize myself as a macro researcher and investor. My background is I studied economics and worked in sell-side financial market research for a while. I was lucky enough to get a bit of an Austrian economics education at my first company and moved into asset management, wanted to be closer to investing the capital and taking risk on the capital and learning through that process. And I actually recently left that job as working as the head of asset allocation for a large South African pension fund to be full-time involved in the Bitcoin markets.
Right, right. And a lot of that time obviously is dedicated to Sound Money Macro, where you publish regular content on the topic of sound money. That is kind of the primary topic that I'd like us to focus on today. But I think we should maybe first begin with understanding what unsound money is. So can you provide an explainer of what unsound money is and maybe contrast it to sound money?
Fantastic. And it's great to know that personal blog that I was writing all these years has found expression with some people's reading. So the way I would simply describe unsound money is a monetary system where there's very little constraint on the quantity of new money that is created. And the easy ways to kind of see that is a monetary system that creates a large quantity of money. And it's important to, of course, make the distinction between quantity of money and wealth. More money does not equal more wealth. It is easy for the central bank and the monetary system through the banking sector to create more quantity of money through changing certain tools at their disposal, right? And I would characterize the world that we live in today as a particularly unsound world from a monetary perspective, because we have record low interest rates, we have record high debt levels in most countries around the world, and same thing, of course, with the interest rates. And the reason for that is because there is very little constraint on the amount of new debt growth. So that's from a definition perspective, and I guess the short implication of that, I know you want to get into more detail on the implications, but the short implication is that I see that as the biggest challenge that we face in the world today and the 2020s going forward.
Right. I made the point before we started recording that I think the pandemic kind of shifted us into, from a policy perspective, almost seeing a de facto modern monetary theory being applied, and that the excessive stimulus, we saw excessive stimulus and artificial low rates. But you rebutted a bit, saying that it's kind of been like that for a while. George, maybe you want to expound?
For sure. Yeah, I think it is a really important point to make. You know, we get this talk of modern monetary theory as though there's some big change that is going to be taking place, or maybe has taken place in 2020, and maybe further changes are afoot. And that is possible, but I think it's critical to note that this trend towards unsound money has been attacked for many years. And once again, also not just in one country, it's not just the US Fed, it's most governments around the world use unsound money as a tool at their disposal, right? It benefits them to try and smooth over any volatility with low interest rates and debt. So whether governments see, and I'm summarizing here, I'm including governments, the Treasury with the central bank, because there obviously are different entities, but they speak to each other very closely in most countries around the world. But the point I'm making here is that whenever they see volatility, whether it be economic volatility, social volatility, political volatility, financial market volatility, the easy, in inverted commas, the short-term an easy way out is to just say, oh, let's just lower interest rates, let's create more debt. In the short term, that seems to make an improvement, and they are completely underweighting what the long-term consequences are of that. So yeah, the point being that this policy of overusing the tools at their disposal has been intact for many years, and it's difficult to know exactly the point. I mean, I guess if you were going to be historically accurate about it, I guess the most important point is probably all the way back to the early 1970s, when the US Fed cut all relationship to commodity money. But you didn't see kind of extreme unsound monetary policies until more kind of the 90s and then the 2000s. It really got going after the dot-com bubble, and then accentuated hugely in 2008, 2009, and then 2020 we've reached a whole new level. But yes, the trend has been intact for a long period of time.
Right. And I guess critics of what you've now been saying, or like proponents of central bank intervention, would say that up until recently they could say, we've done all this stimulus, all this money printing, and we haven't really seen inflation. Obviously, they reference CPI, which is another thing that I want to get us to get into, whether how accurate CPI really is as a measure of inflation. But up until very recently, they could have referenced in CPI and said, we're doing all the stimulus, we're spending, doing a lot of good spending, social spending, infrastructure spending, and we're not seeing a lot of inflation. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, they are completely misunderstanding the dynamics here, and they're becoming very myopically focused on a few simple variables. When you loosen monetary policy and fiscal policy, lowering interest rates and creating debt, there are numerous consequences of those. The primary one, the first implication, is you create a lot more money, and that is in of itself, that is monetary inflation. You have already, by definition, diluted the existing shareholders of that currency. So from that respect, you actually already have experienced monetary inflation. Now, those people you're talking about that would kind of critique me, what all they're doing is they're saying, oh, let's focus on this specific consumer price basket. And if we don't see the consequences on that, then there are no other consequences. And as I said, there are tons of other consequences. When you create lots of new money, it will go somewhere. It will go somewhere in the economy, and we can get into the details of all the different places that it's gone, but oversimplifying, one of the key places that money has gone is into financial assets over the last 20 years, into equities, into bonds, into property. So those assets have gone up substantially, and once again, there's all sorts of consequences of those that I'd love to get into. But the simple answer to your question is that those critics are misunderstanding the relationships, and they're myopically focusing on just basically a theory. And as one of these problems with the economic discipline is that relationship does exist, but it doesn't explain the full picture. Mm. The full picture is far more complex than just the idea that you know, monetary inflation, if it doesn't lead to CPI, is not having a negative consequence. That's a vast oversimplification of the relationship.
Right. It always baffles me that instead of just if we're measuring inflation, why are we looking at a second order effect, CPI, instead of just looking at the actual percentage of M2 inflation that's happening? It completely baffles me. And the Fed very conveniently also looks at core CPI, which excludes energy and food.
Exactly. And I mean, it's because of these reasons which, you know, lead some people to the more skeptical, I guess, the more conspiratorial type theories. You know, I'm always wary to, I always want to veer away from the conspiracy theories and just kind of, you know, focus on the facts at hand. And I think that the facts at hand is that for governments, it is always beneficial to, you know, make use of these tools and to disguise some of the consequences so that they can continue to make use of the tools. You know, governments do not want to have the reins pulled in on them on monetary and fiscal policy, and that's obvious. Yeah, we don't want, I'm not making any kind of conspiracy theory in saying that.
That's definitely the case. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, when all this monetary stimulus happens, that money tends to flow into financial assets. You know, I'd say firstly that that's where the money is going. Maybe secondly, we'll see it play into the real economy, but it definitely goes into risk assets first, and then you see asset price inflation. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, and I mean, I guess the point also to make is it does depend on the dynamics in the economy. It depends on the banking sector. You know, it's possible that money could flow into consumer markets. So let's not discount that possibility. But certainly over the last 20 years, you know, the way that policy has been run, that has been the consequence, right? And it's obvious for everybody to see when there are valuations on equities, valuations on bond markets, where the yields are so incredibly low, particularly across the developed world's prices on property. And I think one of the important follow-on consequences here on the economy and on people and the real world is that benefits certain people,
right?
Right, the holders of those assets, well, that's exactly what they want. And not that I have anything against, you know, holders of assets experiencing appreciation in the asset. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But, of course, the people who don't hold those assets don't have the same experience.
Yeah, they get left behind.
So there's an inherent discriminatory impact of that policy, which the policymakers are very rarely taking into account. In fact, the South African Central Bank governor is one of the rare central bank governors that actually does speak about some of these consequences, which is a wonderful thing, but most central bankers don't speak about it whatsoever. So there's no surprise to me that we struggle with inequality in the world today. And I mean, I think it's important to note once again here, I'm not saying that I think the world should be equal. There's always going to be some degrees of inequalities in the world. But when we have a mechanism here right at the center of the economy, which is exacerbating some of these inequities, that is a serious problem. And it's a serious problem for me when you see politicians saying we're going to solve inequality, but through all of these second order, third order type policies, it's ludicrous that they think they're ever going to work without actually getting to the root of the problem, which is that we have far too low interest rates, far too easy access to debt, which tends to always favor those who already have wealth, who already have assets, and also those who already have, you know, higher education, which are able to, you know, start up the businesses to be able to, you know, mitigate against these consequences of monetary inflation and asset price inflation.
Right. I saw a segment of Stan Druckenmiller, I think it was on CNBC, saying that in 2020, him and all of his billionaire friends had the best year ever. And I think he called the Fed the greatest machine that generates wealth inequality. So, I mean, for someone who benefits from a system like that to come out and speak against it, that really says a lot.
Completely. And one can even, you know, take this concept even wider. It's, you know, it's one of the big farces of centralized policy making in general. You know, governments come out and they say that they're doing all these good things for the man on the street. And so often that is not how it ends up being. As another example, which does actually, I guess, pertain to our conversation. So, you know, governments will make all of these regulations to restrict access for, you know, retail investors to certain investments because they say it's too risky. And then all that happens is that those people don't get access to those exciting or good investments. And the people who do get access are the ones that are already have wealth, already have high incomes, already, you know, well-educated. And you can listen, you can see why they're trying to do what they're doing. But, you know, sometimes the best laid intentions do not result in the right policy. And listen, that's not to say that we should have no policy whatsoever. But, you know, I think in the 2020s, we've got incredibly large amount of policy and red tape. And at the end of the day, actually, that does, once again, it favors rich people, it favors people with high educations, it favors big companies. Those are the companies that have the accountants and the lawyers that can overcome all of this regulation and red tape that government puts in place that's meant to help the little guy, but it doesn't.
Yeah, and to your point, I agree with the fact that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily dispute their motives. Their motives might be, you know, to help. And in this case, or in the Fed's case, for example, to, or what I want to ask you about is the irony of politicians that claim that they want to fight inequality, but it's also these same politicians that support the huge stimulus packages and federal bank interventions. Like I said, I don't dispute their motives, but there is irony there that these two very conflicting sides of the argument are held by the same people.
Completely. And it's just, you know, it's a bad misunderstanding of economics. Economics is a badly misunderstood discipline. It's a very fascinating discipline, but you know, there's no economics is not a hard science, and some people treat it as though it is a hard science, and that is you know, very dangerous. And there's a lot of really dangerous economists out there that espouse all sorts of dangerous ideas and give politicians, who, you know, tend to be not probably as well educated as those economists, and then they kind of default to them as the authority, and they've made some relationship. I mean, as an example, a guy like, you know, Paul Krugman, he would, you know, very much advocate for low interest rates and more quantitative easing and more government debt whenever you know, whenever he thinks it's a good idea. He doesn't see these consequences that we're talking about. So I mean, I think, so I know we'll get on to, you know, Bitcoin and so on, but this is one of the really exciting things about it, is that people are having more of these conversations. That people are now interested. Right. I've never, you know, I studied economics for many years, and kind of people were in passing interested in it. And now people want to talk to me about monetary policy and store of value. And it's really great that these disciplines are you know, getting opened up to the everyday person. Right. to decide for themselves. And hopefully the listener will do that, decide for themselves, you know, what makes sense, you know, with these variables, and our governments, what they're doing, is that really helping us? And if it's not, then, you know, what are we going to do about it?
Exactly, exactly. I think that's a good segue to, we've spoken about this just before we started recording as well, that you wrote a blog post kind of saying that in light of the current macro environment where we've got these artificially low yields, high inflation, that unorthodox risk-taking is required. You know, yo, what does that look like, and what are the alternatives that investors have available to them that's not the classic 60-40 portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of, I guess, almost a like philosophical concept. But yeah, let's try and, I guess, hone in, because you could use that concept in many different realms. But let's speak, you know, specifically about investments. And then we have, you know, pointed out, right, that low interest rates and debt, they flood into financial markets, all sorts of different financial assets. And these are not as cheap as they might have been otherwise. That has the consequence of making investments more difficult, more challenging. And we want to save and invest for our future. And the long-term returns from these assets is not going to be as good as it has been in the past. The relationship between valuation and returns is not non-linear. Like, you know, it's not going to predict returns over the short term, but we do know that overvalued markets tend to give poorer long-term returns. That is a, you know, there is a very clear relationship there. And that is it. That is a challenge. That is a challenge for investment managers. It is a challenge for individuals who are trying to save and invest for their future, save for their children's education, save for a house, save for retirement. So it's always good to draw back to the real consequences. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so then what do you do as an investor? And generally what investors have done over the last 10 years, as yields go down, as valuation goes up, people go further out on the risk curve. Wow. Because you're forced to do that. You need to get that return, whether it's, I don't know, 5% real return or whatever it might be that your target is. Okay, so I'm going to push further out on the risk curve. But of course, eventually you get, you've pushed all the way out on the risk curve and you're absorbing lots more risk into the portfolio than you would otherwise. And that's a challenge, right? And so anyway, I guess the point that I'm making there is, what type of risk does one want to take? Because I guess once again, moving into the Bitcoin world, is that a lot of traditional investors will see Bitcoin as this very unorthodox asset. It's obviously incredibly volatile. It's got this regulatory uncertainty, but whether or not you think it's risky depends on how you look at risk. So from my vantage point, when I'm seeing unsound money as the biggest problem in the world today, and I'm seeing all of the consequences that has had on property markets and equity markets and bond markets, it's not to say that those are awful investments, but if we were at some point ever to see some sort of normalization in those policies, those assets would have to re-rate. And that is a big risk that is... it's very difficult for a traditional investor to protect against, but thinking outside the box, one can, see the potential offered by something like Bitcoin. As one of, from my vantage point, the most profound technological revolution that we've had in many years. So, from that perspective, it's an unorthodox risk, but a potentially a required unorthodox risk to mitigate against this very difficult to hedge risk in traditional portfolios. That's, I guess, what I was getting at there is that we need to be able to, start thinking a little bit differently. Often, investment management, and it's not all investment management companies, but some, they almost like the economist that I mentioned, they have this direct relationship between CPI and monetary policy. Well, investors will say, okay, we're just going to focus on, the long-term returns and the long-term return expectations, and the correlation between these asset classes, in not appreciating what other all sorts of risks they might be consuming in the absorbing in the portfolio. And so an unorthodox understanding of those risks, and then sometimes unorthodox risk taking might be required. I look at Bitcoin as an investment, sure, it is has all sorts of risks. But when you turn the tables on some of these arguments, you can start to think of it as a defensive asset against some risks, that it actually is protecting you against some of these risks that you can't mitigate against with your other investments. And, in this increasingly unorthodox world, this is a really important lens through which to see the world.
Exactly. That really sets us up nicely for what I want to get at the bulk of the podcast. What I want to make the bulk of the podcast about. So I want to ask you about, from your view, that what is your Bitcoin investment case? But if you had to explain your investment thesis to someone, but first maybe just explain your background, journey in Bitcoin. How did you stumble upon the asset, and what were your first initial reactions, and how did you kind of work through that?
Yeah, sure. So, as I mentioned earlier, I was lucky enough, one of my early jobs to have exposure to what we call the Austrian School of Economics, which is a school of economics that is very skeptical of central banking. And that was often a lens through which I analyzed markets, looking at interest rates and money supply growth as the big driver of asset class movements. And that skepticism with central banks did make me an investor in gold, because it is one of these assets that cannot be manipulated by central banks. And that understanding of gold as a store of value allowed me to understand Bitcoin maybe easier than some other people. I mean, I think that it's quite interesting. I mean, maybe less so now, but in years gone by, there were often few different reasons why people might have got interested in Bitcoin. One was kind of the gold world. One was more like kind of the libertarian world, and one was more kind of like coming from the tech world. And those people had an in to understanding the asset. And that was kind of my situation, that I had insight into knowing how much of a problem it was, central banking was, how valuable it was to have a constrained supply asset like gold. And then when I came across Bitcoin and, found out that it was, was going to be an even scarcer asset, and had all these additional properties, that made me quite interested. It took me a while to, comfort myself with the technical aspects. But I was lucky enough to have, a few like mentors in those early days. People who did understand the tech a little bit more were able to provide me with the confidence that, it wasn't easy to kind of just hack Bitcoin or change the protocol or anything like that. So yeah, that was kind of my journey. And I guess from a timeline perspective, it was very much 2016 where that kind of spark went off in my head. And I said I was lucky enough to kind of interact with a few people that helped me along that journey.
Right. And now, given the current macro environment, how would you explain to someone the case for including Bitcoin in a traditional portfolio?
Yeah, so there are a number of different ways that you can go about asking this question, answering this question. And I guess I've almost articulated a little bit of it here, but let me try and summarize. So I think unsound money is the biggest challenge that we face as investors. It's impacted so many economic challenges, so many social challenges like inequality, but also impacted asset markets and made them overvalued. And that the potential for monetary regime change at some point in the future is non-zero. And there's lots of evidence for this, purely in the data itself, with interest rates at record lows, with debt levels at record highs. But then over and above that, if you just look at central banks and what they say, they talk about these things. They talk about the need for monetary reform and monetary change. And they're talking about all these different policies, MMT. They talk, and we've explained why that's not necessarily entirely different. But they might try and make some changes to give themselves even more powers to be even more inflationary from a monetary perspective. We've got those changes that are afoot, and so the potential for monetary regime change is non-zero.
Right.
And it's not that you have to believe that monetary regime change is a certainty in order to invest into Bitcoin. But if that regime change is just bigger than zero, it makes a lot of sense to invest into the asset, because if Bitcoin does have some role to play in that, it will be orders of magnitude more valuable than it is today. And so that's why, I've been making this point a few times, that one can almost see it as a defensive strategy to mitigate against some risk that the monetary regime changes and some risk that Bitcoin has some role to play in that. To have a non-zero allocation is a particularly strong case to make. And that is just one case, but I think it is one of the compelling ones, and particularly compelling to traditional investors.
Right. I guess the rebuttal would be, and I get this a lot from the South African institutional guys, is the fact that they follow you up to the very end of that investment thesis, or almost agreeing with 95% of what you're saying, but then say, no, that just makes the case for gold. How do you respond to that? Should you be including both in your portfolio? Is there some sense in which Bitcoin is superior to gold? How do you address that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one can certainly be thinking of including both in the portfolio. But, you know, yeah, monetary regime change, you know, would likely incorporate, it could incorporate all sorts of things. But I guess, you know, part of the, you know, additional layer of the argument here is that there will be some argument to be made for a return to some certainty at the center of that that monetary system, an asset that, you know, cannot be easily inflated. And gold does have that those properties. Bitcoin just is superior from that respect. So Bitcoin is a not actually just yet. I mean, I think the easy way to analyze the scarcity of an asset is looking at the stock to flow, which Bitcoin investors will be, you know, well aware of. Funny enough, traditional investors are not as well aware of looking at this ratio, but, you know, very quickly, you know, gold is difficult to find, difficult to mine, and it has these, you know, metallurgical or geological properties that it is doesn't corrode and it doesn't erode. So what happens is that we don't really consume gold. We just grow the stock above the ground, and then because the stock keeps on growing, the flow of new growth each year is very small. And so the stock to flow of gold is approximately 60, and it is far superior to most other commodities from this aspect, which is why societies for, you know, many hundreds of years chose gold as the, you know, the center of their monetary systems. Now, the reason why I say that is because, you know, it's easy to calculate that for Bitcoin too, and from, you know, Bitcoin was you know, modeled on gold from this aspect, and so it's not yet as scarce as gold, but it will be, but somewhere in either 2022 or 2023, the stock to flow of Bitcoin will be higher than gold. So then that's just one property of Bitcoins, which will clearly be superior to gold's in the future. I mean, the other properties that are exciting is the fact that it's easy to store. You know, it's almost costless to store Bitcoin, whereas to store gold that costs money. To transport gold is once again is costly, and to transport Bitcoin is trivial, and it's purely digital. And that, I guess, brings this other component into it, that we do live in this digital age, where, you know, particularly amongst the younger generations, have a strong understanding of digital value. So, you know, Bitcoin is this, you know, revolution in money and moving us into this digital age. And then I guess the other component over and above that that is particularly exciting about Bitcoin is that because it's digital, it's programmable. So it has this kind of built-in payments layer. And, you know, because it's digital and programmable, people are building more layers on top of it, more exciting ways to use the asset, you know, things like Lightning, and all sorts of other innovations that will, you know, come on the back of that. So, yeah, I think that there's many arguments to make that, you know, Bitcoin is a superior asset to gold. But from an investment perspective, one can certainly make the argument that both are warranted in a portfolio.
So you touched on second layer scaling there for a bit, and I think that's something that's quite misunderstood by most people. You know, there's always the rebuttal that Bitcoin is kind of slow, especially when the network is busy and congested, that, you know, transactions take up to 20, 30, 40 minutes when the network is quite busy. You know, you mentioned Lightning. You know, what is Lightning Network? How does it help Bitcoin scale? And do you think we'll need eventually more than, you know, just a second layer, maybe third or fourth layer scaling?
Yeah, and maybe even just taking one step back before that is just to note that, you know, Bitcoin still is a very valuable technology even without these second layer solutions. You know, the idea that you can move large quantities of value all the way around the world digitally in a matter of, you know, 30 minutes to get you know, three confirmations is incredibly, incredibly powerful.
At a low cost.
Certainly a low cost, you know, for high value transactions. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, I can understand why some people critique it because you know, that doesn't necessarily lend itself to low value transactions, but it is certainly valuable in of itself. That being said, you want it to be more of a complete solution, and that's what people are working on these layer two solutions, and I think they're incredibly exciting. But one can also even just make the point that there's lots of different types of layer two solutions. I mean, Lightning is one type of layer two solution, but another type of layer two solution is even something like an exchange. So if you and I are customers of the same exchange, we can send Bitcoin internally, generally for very low fees, because what the exchange will do was just allow us to move that internally, and then they'll settle transactions amongst customers at the end of the day, and because they're batching those together, then you're not paying high transaction fees. So that's another type of second layer solution. I'm not saying it's the ideal solution, but it is a solution, and all sorts of other payment processes could do the same thing. Of course, what's exciting about Lightning is that it's entirely Bitcoin native solution.
There's no counterparty risk involved.
Exactly.
So the exchanges.
Yeah. So it's a very exciting innovation. But it is important to note that you could even imagine a world where you have Bitcoin and no Lightning, and just all sorts of other second layer solutions that kind of link into the traditional world. Lightning brings a lot of other functionality from a speed perspective, from a cost perspective, from a decentralized perspective, and anonymity. It is incredibly exciting. And I think I would encourage listeners to look into the company called Strike. They still got a long way to go before it's user friendly for all users. But what they are working on and what they achieved in El Salvador using Lightning is incredibly exciting.
Right.
I love the way that Jack Mallers, who's just obviously a big Bitcoiner, but actually what he's focused on is kind of Bitcoin the network rather than even just the asset, and right. The idea that they're working on being able to send any currency between any currency pair, but like across the Bitcoin network at almost zero speed and zero cost is incredibly exciting. So I'm watching them closely and hoping that they do achieve all the success that they're talking about.
Jack is an extremely ambitious guy, very driven. I listened to a podcast with Preston Pesh where he said that he's certain that Strike is going to become the most valuable company in the world.
He's very confident, yeah. So let's see. But I'm backing them. I'm watching them, and it's a very exciting path that they're walking down.
Definitely. Just from you mentioned the El Salvador thing. Jack was very responsible for what happened there, played a large role. How significant do you think that actually is for Bitcoin adoption going forward?
Good question. How significant? I think it is very significant, right? It's the first country to adopt Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, and that is an important stepping stone. So, you also can't overemphasize it. It is a small country, but it is a big step in the right direction. So I think it's very exciting that we've seen a country take that step, and it does have this this almost contagion type effect, right, that other people see it and they get interested in it, and Bitcoin that whole concept speaks quite nicely to Bitcoin, that it has this it's a network, and so as people talk about it, it grows the interest and it influences other people. Of course, there are some negative consequences to that, because a lot of people do get attracted to Bitcoin just because they see the price increase. But that is what it is. Bitcoin, as we'll talk about, number go up technology, and it just is what it is. It causes people to get interested in Bitcoin, and not every story is almost always a positive one. It's possible that the El Salvador story is not as positive as we hope. It's possible that the president there, is just a dictator, and maybe he doesn't do as good policies for his people as we hope. That is possible. But the fact is that the technology of Bitcoin had an impact there in El Salvador, and it caused the president there to say, we have high percentage of remittances. A lot of that value is getting lost in the value chain because they're using all of these, like third-party intermediaries and Western Union. If we use this Bitcoin technology, we can reduce that cost and reduce the speed, and we can boost our GDP. And that's the free market in action, and it's the free market allows good technologies, good ideas to impact people, and we're going to see more of that in the future.
Definitely. And I guess probably the biggest disappointment with the El Salvador thing from a Bitcoin perspective is that we thought the first thing that a country would do was to the Federal Reserve, Central Bank, maybe putting some on their balance sheet. So we haven't seen that yet, but that's also quite possible. Or what do you rate the possibility of that?
Definitely possible. And I would say the biggest disappointment actually for me with El Salvador is the kind of forcing people to accept Bitcoin. Yes. Like that's not really in the ethos of Bitcoin. And I certainly do hear those critiques. And so we just got to be aware of them. And I think we already have said this, but it's good to reiterate the point that it's very positive news, but we also should never hero worship is kind of the, it's like why you should also never, hero worship Elon Musk when he comes along and makes an announcement about Bitcoin or any other individual. It's all about the technology, the ideas, the principles. If we stick to ideas and principles, then we have, I think, a lot better chance of better long-term outcomes in the world. It's far too many people that are, hero worshiping and just doing what other people say they should do. But yes, on the topic of central banks, we certainly will see a government at some point adopt Bitcoin on its balance sheet, and we just got to kind of watch out for that that possibility. I mean, it could very well be El Salvador, but I mean, El Salvador doesn't have a central bank, so they more have this kind of the sovereign fund that they've set up to help El Salvadorians that are accepting or forced to accept Bitcoin, unfortunately. But the mechanism that they've put in place is that they will have this fund that will buy that Bitcoin from the El Salvadorians if they don't want to hold on to it, and they can hold on to whatever they would rather hold on to, which is obviously more likely to be, not more likely, but if they don't want Bitcoin, then they're going to hold on to dollars. They don't have a central bank. But yeah, I mean, at some point in the future, some central bank is going to think about that. It's an interesting one to think through, right? Because it comes back to all these earlier points that we were making, is that there's very few central banks that are trying to protect the value of their currency. Right. There's very few central banks that are trying to enhance the value of their currency. Most of these central banks are using their central bank, using the tools at their disposal to try and juice monetary policy, to try and inflate away their problems. So, from that respect, adding Bitcoin to the balance sheet is entirely kind of contradictory to the policies that they're trying to run.
Yeah, that it would completely constrain their ability to enact stimulus, for example.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily, it depends how they do it. So if the Fed just kind of bought some Bitcoin, it doesn't constrain them. Of course, they'd have to explain what they're doing. So that would get us down a whole kind of another interesting road. What would certainly constrain them if they tried to peg their currency
to... Right, if they went on Bitcoin standard.
Yes. Right. That is very difficult for most countries. The reason why it was easy in El Salvador is because they'd already given away their monetary policy. Right. They already weren't sovereign from a monetary policy perspective because they were already pegged to the dollar. So the switch over there was quite easy. But by contrast, most countries that have their own currency and their own central bank, most of them use that central bank. They use that tool at their disposal, and they are very hesitant, very reticent to give up that tool. You know, the South African government is not going to easily give away the Saab and the benefits that affords them.
Right. I guess if that were to happen, you know, Bitcoin being put onto a government's or central bank balance sheet, it would be a more from a game theoretic perspective as opposed to a monetary perspective, in the sense that maybe Russia would want to de-dollarize or China would want to de-dollarize. Obviously, China's not putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet likely, but I think you know, if the Saudis or the Russians were to want to de-dollarize, the Bitcoin would be the kind of tool to do it.
Yes, a very good point. And I think you know, what they would most likely do is also like kind of do it in stealth.
Mm.
You know, so maybe not necessarily announce it,
right,
and just, you know, accumulate in the background, and then you know, make some change in the future or some announcement in the future. But you know, I'm not sure if it's too much of their interest in the short term, unless they are, you know, looking to position themselves as you know, haven for capital, and that could very well happen at some point in the future. And I guess it, you know, gets us onto all this, you know, conversation of the game theory of Bitcoin regulation and banning. But yeah, at the extreme case scenario, if you do see governments you know, ban Bitcoin, likely that you'll see some governments defect from that, and in that situation they would be attracting a huge amount of capital into their borders, because of course there are a lot of, you know, Bitcoiners around the world, and they would prefer to live in countries where their asset was welcomed.
Right. It's kind of the world's biggest and most fragile prisoner's dilemma. If governments were across the globe were to want to coordinate a Bitcoin ban, the first defector would get all of the benefits of Bitcoiners, you know, moving their assets or their wealth to that country. So I don't really see governments being able to coordinate the ban, a global ban on Bitcoin at all, just because the rewards for defecting are so big.
Completely. And over and above that, the appetite for global coordination is just lower today than it was in the past. And we are living in strange times, where there is more pressure on politicians, and politicians have, you know, they face slightly more inwardly during those times. So it's more difficult to coordinate externally. I mean, do you think that the US and China are going to coordinate on their Bitcoin policy? Maybe, but less likely, as I said, today than it, you know, in the past. Yeah, so there are lots of other, you know, steps we can go on from the Bitcoin banning side, but yeah, I think that global coordination is unlikely. You know, what's interesting is that what more frequently happens is that the more freedom loving countries are interested in the technology, interested in the innovation, interested in the companies that grow in their borders, the jobs that get created, and then the tax revenue that they can get from that, and they're cautious to do something silly. Whereas your smaller, not always smaller, but your more authoritarian-leaning governments sometimes are a little bit arrogant in how much of an impact they can have. And it tends to be those countries, those governments that take the foolhardy steps of banning Bitcoin. You know, places like Turkey, places like Nigeria, places like China, which is not obviously a small country, but is an authoritarian country. And what's interesting is that it's in those countries that the people already have quite a strong understanding of the value of the technology. So by the time the government makes those steps, a large enough percentage of the people in that country just kind of ignore what the government says. You know, when you know, Nigeria, they didn't ban Bitcoin, but they tried to clamp down on withdrawals from exchanges. Local Bitcoin transactions went through the roof in Nigeria thereafter. You know, in Turkey, they clamped down on merchants being able to accept Bitcoin. And the same thing happened.
Peer-to-peer volumes go through the roof.
So, it's you know, I like this phrase that if you think your government is going to ban Bitcoin, then you need it more than you think.
Right.
Because by the time the government is gone to take such a silly step, to be quite frank, as to reject freedom-loving technology and to reject a technology that you can't even really ban. Obviously they can make it illegal, but you know, a person holding Bitcoin can still have that Bitcoin. They can still log onto the internet. They can still use VPNs to access their wallets. So if a government wants to ban Bitcoin, all they're really doing is saying they want to ban themselves from Bitcoin. Right. Bitcoin doesn't go away. It continues to run. And the people who've self-custodied their assets still have access to those funds, which is why, you know, self-custody is such an important consideration for Bitcoin. But yeah, the tag phrase being, yeah, if you think your government is going to ban Bitcoin, then you really need this technology and this asset more than you think.
I was going to ask you about, you know, the importance of self-custody. I think that's an important thing, especially in South Africa, where we have two very reputable exchanges. A lot of people just, you know, leave their coins on exchanges. You know, what is the importance of self-custody and how does one begin about, starting to think about it and how do you do it?
Yeah, so, I mean, the complete, you know, idea of Bitcoin is being able to be your own bank. So if you self-custody, you know, you're taking control of that asset. You're taking the responsibility as well, and you're taking the risks onto your own person. But then once you've self-custodied, then you can be your own bank. You can transact, you know, with anybody on the Bitcoin network, anywhere in the world, any time of day, without asking anyone for permission. You don't have to ask the bank for permission. You don't have to ask the SARB for permission, your central bank. That is a very exciting prospect. And so while I completely appreciate that self-custody is not for everybody, and it's not, and there are, you know, solutions for, you know, some people to overcome that, because as I said, there are risks. So, you know, once you self-custody your assets, you need to have stored those passwords securely, because if you lose those passwords, then you lose, you know, access to that Bitcoin. So, I mean, clearly there are risks. I'm not discounting that, but I do really encourage people to experience Bitcoin, to, you know, download, to get those passwords and conduct a transaction. And your heart beats a little bit faster, and you get nervous through the process, but it's very exhilarating.
Right.
You know, the idea that you can send money peer to peer and store that money, you know, peer to peer. Once you've secured those passwords as well, you know, you can be pretty confident, you know, that no one's going to steal it from you. That, you know, that's great. And listen, and there are risks with exchanges. There's the regulatory risk that the regulator in that country suddenly changes the policy, and that exchange has to comply with it, and that, you know, maybe you can't have the access to the funds that you hoped that you might. And then over and above that, there are hacking risks with exchanges. Now, listen, one has to balance that risk, which is certainly a risk, but exchanges do have security, you know, measures in place. I don't want to, you know, talk down their security measures. So one does have to trade that off versus the responsibility of self-custodying your keys and the potential that you lose all that capital, which would be a disaster. One has to, you know, just think about these risks. But every person, you know, who's invested in Bitcoin should give some thought to this, and certainly once anybody has any sizable amount of capital in it, you know, if you're buying just a small amount of money, then yeah, sure, you know, buy it on exchange, start learning about the technology. You know, maybe you don't want to self-custody if you have, you know, a few hundred rands, but you know, once you're getting a sizable amount of wealth in Bitcoin, an amount of money that you wouldn't want to lose, start looking into self-custody and really experience Bitcoin, true Bitcoin, because holding on exchange, you're not experiencing true Bitcoin.
Right. you touched on the permissionless characteristics of the network, where I can send value to anyone in the world on a Sunday night, midnight, without asking anyone for permission, without signing off with my bank or anything like that. So that is really the beauty, and that's also why I had such a laugh about the headlines of the central banks, the SARB, saying that it's now illegal to send Bitcoin to an offshore wallet. That was just cute, naive. How did you think about that news, coming through, and how do you think they're going to try and enforce it?
Yeah, so the way I simply thought through what we saw there is that I think, and this is just my assumption, so it's just an opinion of mine, it's not fact, but I see a burgeoning industry in South Africa. Bitcoin and crypto penetration is high in South Africa. It's one of the highest in the world. I think Nigeria is the highest, and we're definitely in the top 10, and we might even be in the top 5 in terms of crypto penetration. And so a burgeoning industry, and you've got a government that doesn't have a lot of control over it. And governments like to control things. And so the way I see it is that they're looking in their regulatory toolkit that already exists, and they're saying to themselves, okay, well, we have these rules. How do we apply it to this asset to get a bit more control? That's the way I see it. And so capital control regulations are seemingly look like they're an easy way to apply, at least mentally it seems easy to apply. In actuality, we'll see that it is very difficult to apply, but it kind of, they're looking at they're looking at these big exchanges, and they're saying, oh, okay, people are buying this asset, and they're moving it to a Chinese regulated company. Oh, so they're circumventing capital control regulations. That's the way they can see it, and you can see it from their opinion, right? But they're failing to grapple really with what's going on here, because Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, they completely make a farce of capital controls, and capital controls were really a farce beforehand anyway, but they've now really just kind of blown them out the water. Wow. So the idea that they're going to the idea they're going to implement them is, I think, quite farcical. There are some question marks being raised about whether it is even going to be pushed through. I hear from pretty reputable sources that they might actually repeal what they've said. But even in the current context, what they've said is that South Africans shouldn't be moving capital, from South African exchanges to offshore exchanges. But this is quite ridiculous, because you can, of course, just withdraw that capital from your South African exchange to a personal wallet and then move it wherever you want. And if you wanted to,
you can mix it as well.
Exactly. You could mix it if need be. Listen, if they were going to try and enforce that, what they would probably do is almost, they could force South African exchanges to force all of their clients to fill out a form when they withdraw their capital. They could do something like that. And that, of course, would add quite a layer of friction onto it, which would be very frustrating. And hopefully that's not where we come to. As we said, it would still be you could still circumvent it even under the current regulations. But yeah, that's where we stand. It doesn't make a huge amount of sense, but it's really, and you also do have to sympathize with the regulators here, because what they really need to do is sit down and rethink that kind of the whole framework. And that's just really difficult to do. It reminds me now of our earlier part of the conversation about monetary regime change. That's a whole rethink. That's really, it's difficult to do that. It's certainly difficult to do that with a massive government with all these different departments, FSB, SARB, Treasury, and for them to coordinate and get around the table and make a whole new regulatory regime that allows for this decentralized, permissionless, global digital asset is
going to be something to witness.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
You mentioned earlier the kind of Euro worship that of I think the Bitcoin community kind of went through that with Elon. We kind of loved him with Tesla putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and then he went the whole Doge route, kind of ticked everyone off.
Is it Doge or Doggy Coin?
I've heard both, Dogecoin, Doggy Coin. But he kind of went that route, and then very surprisingly, kind of criticized Bitcoin for its environmental impact. With the kind of massive move towards ESG from an institutional perspective, how do you think about Bitcoin's environmental impact, and how does it fit into this kind of ESG narrative?
Yeah, and there's a lot that can be said here. It is quite a complicated topic, but let's let's dive into it. So Bitcoin miners use electricity, right? Now that is unequivocally true. Well, they use hashing power, and hashing power uses electricity. Because Bitcoin is this transparent network, you can see how much hashing power is being used. And then what people do is they backwork how much electricity, they assume how much electricity could be used by the network by essentially using average electricity costs. Now there's lots of, and maybe just to conclude there, so when you look at those estimates, it looks like a lot of energy. Now there is obviously a partial truth there. I mean, there certainly is a fair amount of energy being used. We can't ignore that, but it is a half truth. There's a lot of detail below the surface, right? That a lot of that a lot of that electricity is actually wasted electricity. I learned more about the electricity industry in the last few years than the previous years. What you actually figure out about the electricity industry is although electricity is obviously scarce, but that doesn't mean that we use all of it. Energy consumers want electricity at certain times, at certain times of day, certain times of year, in certain places, and electricity doesn't transport well, doesn't store very well, and so Bitcoin miners are actually this incredible innovation that allow. I mean, they're quite small, the miners themselves, and they can transport to random places, to far flung places, to absorb that wasted electricity. So yeah, what I'm saying is that the estimates are not entirely accurate. A lot of the electricity would have been wasted anyway, and that's just one side to this argument. Over and above that, potentially the even more important argument is that how much environmental damage does our unsound monetary system cause. It's my opinion that the unsound monetary system is actually the biggest cause of environmental damage, because what are central banks trying to do when they lower interest rates and encourage people to take on debt? They're specifically encouraging people to consume, and by implication they're trying to cause people to consume what they wouldn't have otherwise. So if you're consuming more than you would have otherwise, well, that's consuming scarce resources. And we have a scarcity of resources. So if we're using up those resources, it's going to have an environmental impact. The way I see it, it's this consistent barrage of pressure towards low interest rates and debt creation and overconsumption. It's these forces which drive people to damage the environment, to drive more cars, to drive further than they would have otherwise, to fly more planes, to build more houses, because we've taken away the natural constraint. And it's not to say that I think there's anything wrong against driving or cars or flying or any of these things, but we don't have the constraint in place that is causing people to price their actions appropriately. And so, Bitcoin is not going to solve that problem on day one. But what we're working towards here is a monetary system where there is a constraint at the center, where there isn't just abundant access to credit. You can't just consume what you want. And you actually see that in action in Bitcoiners. Bitcoiners, And it, listen, that is that there's a negative component to this. That's, you know, some people see it as, you know, slightly religious, and you know, we can get into that. But what you do see amongst Bitcoin is a commitment to consuming less. They have this scarce asset that they can invest into, and that causes them to be more judicious in their consumption decisions. And that has these positive implications, that you're not damaging the environment as much. So I said there's a lot there. I think the energy argument, one, is misunderstood, just, you know, even in the argument that the people are making. But over and above that, we need sound money. So even if it costs a lot of electricity, it actually is a worthwhile usage of that electricity.
And that was, I think, an argument that Satoshi himself made. I think he compared it with gold, saying that, you know, does gold mining have value? If yes, then sure, then the costs of gold mining are outweighed by the benefits. So I think the question with regards to Bitcoin's value proposition, or the Bitcoin's energy usage, comes down to its value proposition. If we see a value in having this permissionless, open source monetary network, then yes, it kind of justifies all the cost.
Exactly. And what's beautiful about Bitcoin, it is the free market. So, you know, if Bitcoin miners really do consume so much electricity that it is a big problem, we will see some reaction to it. And you know, we'll see this battle of ideas. The battle of ideas is playing out, and you know, it's very interesting to partake. And I'm, you know, I'm convicted about where it will play out, and I know what side of the argument that I'm batting for.
You've obviously had your finger on the pulse of like local institutions over the last couple of years. Do you see the same kind of interest from local institutions as we saw in the US? You know, obviously MicroStrategy, Square, Tesla, I think they're kind of outliers in terms of institutional interest. Do you see anything like that in South Africa?
Yeah, so there are a few tech companies. You probably, it's better actually to ask this question to Fazam from Fela when you speak to him, because, you know, interacts with a lot of these guys directly. But I do know that there are a few you know, tech companies that have adopted in South Africa. I mean, that have you know, put Bitcoin on their balance sheet. But there is from the rest of the corporate market, I mean, I think there is a big difference between, you know, South Africa and the US. You know, South Africa does tend to be just more conservative generally. You know, I'm very well aware of that, you know, from an investment perspective. Whereas in the US. I mean, I didn't mention it, but I actually live in the U.S. at the moment, and you experience that kind of entrepreneurial culture out there. Americans are entrepreneurial; they're risk taking. They see an idea, they go for it, and so that lends them leans them towards adopting these new ideas sometimes, you know, quicker than others. Obviously, it doesn't mean that everyone in the market will. But you know, some of them grasp the ideas and then also see the opportunity. You know, Michael Saylor from MicroStrategy characterizes that well, because while he obviously does understand it and he's a great advocate of the ideas, I think it would be foolhardy to deny that he's probably also being quite opportunistic about it from a marketing perspective. And he's saying, okay, well, I can do this and I can get all this publicity for doing what I'm doing. Anyway, I guess the point I'm making is that, you know, I think it doesn't surprise me that you see more of that in a place like America. Their culture kind of leads them more towards that, where, you know, in South Africa, as I said, it's, you know, it's the tech companies that kind of get it a little bit more, and general South African corporates don't as much. And maybe, you know, one just additional bit there is, I guess, you know, digging in the investment industry in South Africa is, you know, particularly characterized by, you know, a fair amount of conservatism. It's a very strong investment management industry here, but I do think that they have a slight blind side in terms of understanding some of these different technologies. Certainly, the store of value technologies. That was my experience in the investment management industry, that even an asset like gold, and of course I'm not speaking about the whole industry, there's a massive amount of people and companies in South Africa, but a number of them really didn't, they were smart money managers who invested money very well and got great returns for their clients over many years, but really struggled to understand a store of value asset, right, like gold. They just didn't have the intellectual framework. That's it. Not to say that they weren't smart people, they were, but it requires a different intellectual framework to understand these different assets. So anyway, that's just like an additional insight why, you know, I'm not surprised by, you know, some corporates in South Africa being slower.
And like you mentioned as well, maybe there's also a lack of thinking from the kind of the Austrian perspective, where you would kind of approach thinking about money from a very skeptical, you would be skeptical of any central authority. I think that also informs a Bitcoiner's worldview quite well, and gold bugs for that matter. If you aren't skeptical, aren't necessarily as, if you don't tend to be skeptical about central authorities, you'd also struggle to kind of understand the need for a decentralized open source monetary network.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
In terms of, you know, central bank digital currencies, just maybe briefly, what do you think would be the effect, you know, when the ECB or the Fed launch their, you know, CBDCs? Do you think that'll push more interest towards Bitcoin, the kind of more surveillance that entails, mm-hmm. or do you think it'll be kind of a non-event?
Yeah, I mean, maybe before getting directly to your question, it's important to note that central bank digital currencies aren't like cryptocurrencies. Yeah. They aren't using blockchain technology. Blockchain is used to allow decentralized consensus, and central bank digital currencies are not going to be decentralized. No. They're going to be centralized currencies. So it's, you know, very important. That's, and it is an important starting point, right? Because and it also ties into a lot of the things we, you know, spoken about earlier. You know, central banks are not going to be modeling what they're doing on something like Bitcoin or any other constrained supply asset for that matter, because they feel the need to loosen monetary policy, to make use of that tool, to lower interest rates, to use more debt. So, you know, chances are that, you know, once they execute this change in their monetary systems, that they will find a way to further accentuate these policies. And the way that they, I mean, the big difference that they are talking about with central bank digital currencies, I mean, I guess, you know, to get into the just technical differences, is what they are thinking about doing is having each individual in a country or economy will have a direct account with the central bank. So, you know, circumventing the banking sector altogether, because, you know, currently, while central banks obviously control monetary policy, they don't control the growth in credit to you know, households and corporates and individuals. And so if governments, also if central banks were to, you know, cut out banks, then that would give them a more direct access, well, consumers more direct access to the central bank, and the central bank would be able to more kind of directly impact policy. And as a result, I mean, you know, coming to my previous point, that would allow them to push more credit and money into the economy. The way they're going to sell the idea is to say, oh, well, we'll target the areas of the economy that need it. They'll make that social and political argument that, oh, well, we can target the poorer people. We can target the people that have been hard done by COVID or whatever it might be. So it'll sound like it's a good argument. But of course, it'll be even... They'll have more discriminatory tools at their disposal. Right. And while, as I said, they'll sell it as though it's a good idea, and we know from past experience that chances are it's not going to turn out how they intend. So that's, you know, your actual question was, what is the impact for Bitcoin? Well, if this is an asset where they're going to create even more of it, I guess the point I'm making here is it's not going to compete with something like Bitcoin. In fact, it could accelerate the trend towards it, because not only are these currencies now going to be debased even quicker, but over and above that, the people who were skeptical of Bitcoin in the first place will now say, okay, well, my government has given me some sort of version of this thing anyway. So now the barrier to entry into Bitcoin has been lowered even further.
Exactly.
So, they're not going to compete, and they could very well accelerate the trend into Bitcoin and digital assets.
Do you have any concern of financial surveillance from a CBDC perspective?
Yes, big concern, because they're going to have all these direct accounts. They'll be able to kind of see what's going on in people's bank account, be able to
sense the transactions.
Yeah, open up the taps to credit or tighten those taps to credit. So that is, it's definitely a concern.
Rob, yeah, I think we're kind of running out of time. Thanks so much for joining me and having this great discussion. There's so much more that I'd like to get into when I get you on the podcast eventually, hopefully. Just in the meantime, where can people go to find out more about you and read a bit up about all the things we spoke about now?
Sure, yeah. Thanks a lot for having me. It's been good conversation. Yeah, we can obviously carry it on going forward. Where can you find me? On Twitter at SoundMoneyM. And my website is soundmoneymacro.com.
Perfect. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Absolute pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into the Plan B podcast. A quick reminder that the ideas expressed by the hosts or guests during the show are for informational and entertainment purposes only. Nothing contained in this episode constitutes financial, legal, or tax advice, and nor should any opinions be construed as solicitations or inducements to make a financial investment. Do your own research.